This paid program may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. Health Information Technology, or Health IT, has the potential to transform the practice of healthcare by reducing cost, improving quality, and enabling a patient-centered approach to care. Simply put, health information technology is just a way of collecting and moving around information. It can be viewed as the circulatory system for information. Information is the lifeblood of medicine, health IT, the heart and arteries of that information. While health IT offers much promise, there is a need for leadership, coordinated action, unity of effort, and common agreement for this promise to become a reality. What are the benefits of using health IT? What does meaningful use mean as relates to electronic health records? And how has the national adoption and use of health IT, especially electronic health records, progressed? What more needs to be done? We'll explore these questions and so much more with our very special guest, Dr. Farzad Mostashari, National Coordinator for Health IT within the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Doctor, welcome to the show. It's great to have you.
Thank you.
Also joining our conversation from IBM is Gio Patterson. Gio, welcome.
Thank you.
So before we delve into specific initiatives, perhaps you can give us a brief overview of the history and mission of the Office of National Coordinator for Health IT. Could you tell us a little bit about how it's organized and what it does?
Yeah, absolutely. We coordinate U.S. national policies and work on standards for the health information technology sector in the United States. We regulate electronic health records through our certification program, and we work with our colleagues at CMS on defining the principles and the rules behind the meaningful use health IT incentive program for doctors and hospitals and the certification criteria and standards for the electronic health records. I'm very proud of the work that these 170 dedicated public servants do every day. The office was started, and I think this goes a little bit to the point that this really has always been a nonpartisan, bipartisan issue. It was actually created under President Bush under executive order. David Brailer was the first national coordinator. When I joined the federal government in 2009 under David Blumenthal, there were 31 or 32 individuals in that office. We've now since grown, obviously, with the much greater range of responsibilities and the authorities given under high tech. But we are still, I think, relatively small, but fulfill a key coordination role.
What kind of budget do you have?
Our budget is the same as it was under David Brailer 8 years ago. Hasn't been adjusted for inflation even, and it's around $60 million.
I'd like to focus more on your specific responsibilities as the National Coordinator of Health IT. What are your duties and areas under your purview? And more interestingly, how do your efforts support the overall mission of HHS?
That last part is the key, and we really do try to work backwards from the goals to what we need to do. So the goals really of getting to better health for all Americans, better health care, and lower cost. And we know that our healthcare system, anyone who's been a patient or worse yet, loved someone who's a patient in a hospital or is sick, knows how the healthcare system in some very obvious ways doesn't meet the ideals of the people who work in there. And we also know that there's a lot of things we don't know in terms of the ways the system fails people in ways that you never actually know about. And in particular, I think it's those errors of omission, the follow-ups that don't happen, the care coordination that doesn't happen, the people who don't talk to each other, the welcoming of the patient's participation, the family's participation in their health care, those all contribute to the fact that we're paying twice as much as other countries and getting worse health outcomes for it. And if we're going to change that, and I think we are going to change that, I'm actually tremendously optimistic, there needs to be new incentives for healthcare, a new culture, frankly, in terms of how we deal with patients and with prevention. But you can't really do some of those things without having a technology infrastructure. And that's what I see are the core unique part of our mandate and what we need to contribute to the national conversation and to our colleagues at Health and Human Services is the creation of a national infrastructure that can help us learn, that can help us measure care, that can help us improve care, that can help us relate to patients, that can help us coordinate care, that can help us do population health management. Those are some of the key things that I see as being really, if we can't help provide that infrastructure, that foundation, we will not have done our job.
Mm-hmm. In a sense, I don't know if you want to call them operational challenges, but I'm interested to know, once you took the role as the National Health IT Coordinator, what are some of the challenges you faced?
Well,
you sought to address them. Yeah.
Yeah. So I took over on April 8th, 2011, and some of your listeners will remember that April 8th, 2011 was the day we were supposed to shut down the government. So first and foremost among our challenges was the tremendous uncertainty around budgets. We haven't had a real budget since then, and there's been considerable uncertainty, you know, down month to month, week by week, sequester, impact on travel and conferences, impact on our ability to plan our investments. This has been, I think, a challenging time to have kind of a new initiative that has changing and dynamic needs, and obviously a sector where there's so much dynamism in terms of what's happening for that, and the requirement for us to keep up with that change and to adapt to it, and not having that ability to has really, I think, been a real challenge as the national coordinator. What has helped, frankly, has been that we, unlike some other countries, we didn't say we're going to buy all the IT, we're going to be the ones in the contracts, we're going to, you know, we're in the actual putting the systems in place in hospitals and so forth. We have taken very much an approach that I think is the American approach to solving problems, which is to say that the people who make the purchasing decisions should be the people who have to live with the systems. Mm-hmm. And we have set standards, we've created certification, we've provided incentive payments. But ultimately, it's the doctors and hospitals who have to buy the systems and implement them and use them. And that partnership with industry, the partnership with providers, is where a lot of this progress made has come, has been because we have so many strong partners who are really pulling the load on this health IT journey on the outside.
Along with these challenges you've encountered, leading an organization focused on facilitating the adoption and use of health IT in ways that help improve care and improve community health and make care more efficient, you could also be fraught with unanticipated or unexpected surprises. To that end, what has surprised you most since taking your current role?
Well, one thing that has been a surprise is how quickly some of this progress has been made. Honestly, when I started here, you know, it was 96% of prescriptions were paper. And now it's the majority are electronic, right? Healthcare usually doesn't change that quickly, right? You know, 92% of hospitals hadn't adopted electronic health records. They did it for their billing, but not for their patient care. And now we have 80% of hospitals who are in the meaningful use program. And, you know, that's just an incredible swing.
So, Doctor, I'm interested to know, for you, what are the characteristics of an effective leader and what lessons have you brought from your previous experience to what you've done now?
Every leader leads in their own way and in a way that makes sense for them. And I like to think that they rise to the challenge of the needs of the situation. And those needs change. One of the best things anyone ever said when I was named the national coordinator was that ONC has always had the right leader for the time. And as many of your listeners may know, I've decided that it's time for me to move on, and I fully expect the next leader to take up that gauntlet. and take up that challenge in their own way. But for me personally, what has been the leadership skills that I've leaned on the most has been to help connect what we're doing with technology to really where we need to go and to map out that vision of healthcare that truly knows its patients, where all the world's knowledge is used in taking care of every patient encounter, and every patient encounter contributes to all of that world's knowledge and that learning, and that we get to a point where we don't have people dying unnecessarily as they are doing today every day. So having that motivation, mission, passion, and connecting it to the mission and passion of everyone else out there who maybe is, you know, laboring unappreciated, unsung heroes in the back room somewhere, and connecting it to this amazing trend and change that's happening, bringing that significance to bear, I think has been one of the most important things I've contributed.
What are the benefits of using health IT? We will ask Dr. Farzad Mastashari, National Coordinator for Health IT, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. What is fast government, and how can focusing on time and speed deliver real and lasting benefits? How are VA and HUD working to end chronic homelessness among veterans? What is national health security, and how do we get there as a country? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. We bring you insights and interviews from government executives who are changing the way government does business. All of this and more in the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine. Download or order your free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Dr. Farzad Mastashari, National Coordinator for Health IT within the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Also joining us from IBM is Gio Patterson. So, Doctor, technology is not just is just a tool, really, in a sense, but it's a critical tool to foster much needed innovation in entrenched industries like healthcare, which can be perceived as such. Perhaps you could give us a sense, and our listeners a sense, of what we mean exactly by health information technology, and more particularly, what are some of the key components that make up health IT?
Yeah, and also, you know, we say this, and I think some accept it, and others may be more skeptical. What do you mean? It's critical foundation. Why, you know, why can't we? You know, people have been taking care of patients with pen and paper for 5,000 years or more. Why do you say that this is the foundation? Look, it is the needs of healthcare and how healthcare is delivered have changed dramatically. We now have many, many, many more providers touching every patient. Coordination of care becomes really much more difficult. And in a 24/7 world with, you know, there's the expectation that information is just going to be available on your mobile phone, on the go, in the middle of the night. And it's no longer acceptable to say, I'll, you know, go back to the office and I'll pull the chart and I'll get back to you. So there's some part of this modernization in healthcare that relates to direct patient care, right? Do I know this patient? Can I learn what their healthcare journey has been? Can I graph their lab values? And can I quickly retrieve that piece of information? Can I share that information with my colleagues? Can I access it if I'm called by the emergency room at 2 in the morning? And right now, up until recently, in a paper-based world, that was a crapshoot, right? Who's got the chart? Where's the chart? Am I in my other office? Oh, we got to call over for the charts in the other office. I think I remember the patient, right? But that idea, that part of it, is the most superficial, frankly, part of electronic health records, turning the healthcare experience into bits and bytes as opposed to scribbles on a piece of paper. The real transformation comes when that data comes to life. And when I write on paper and I close that file, that data is dead. And it only comes to life when the next person opens it, it goes through their eyes, to their brain, and they process that information. It is lazy data, dead data. Whereas with electronic information, clinical information, that data can be used to do something like, one, make a list of patients. So think for a moment about if we lived in a world where doctors and hospitals had a reason to ask the question of all my patients with diabetes, how many of them are under good control and how many are not? How many are under poor control, haven't seen me for the past 6 months, and are not on insulin? If we really want a healthcare system that can answer that question, that basic kind of management question that every retailer, no retailer could survive nowadays without being able to answer those kind of questions about their customers, right? We can't do that. If we can't do that in healthcare, then we're leaving lives on the table. And that is what we call population health management. Being able to make a list of patients, send them reminders, understand how we're doing, to be able to step on a scale and have metrics for our own behavior and to track and improve on those metrics. That, I think, is for me, is what really defines the transformative potential of health information technology, making those bits and bytes available. And then it's the promise of the future. It's that once that information is electronic, that we can learn things, there can be associations, there can be the big data and the small decisions that flow from it, the learning that can come for public health, for research, for safety. You know, it's an age of data, and we're bringing that data to healthcare.
Farzad, your office is charged with improving health and healthcare for all Americans through the use of IT. I'd like to explore the strategic vision that frames the direction of your office. Would you highlight your key strategic goals and outline the federal health IT principles that inform your strategic approach?
Absolutely. There are five elements in our strategic plan. The first is to increase adoption and exchange of health information. That's the basic foundation. That's the basic nuts and bolts of what we have to do. The second is to draw ever more tightly the connection between those and the outcomes we seek. So the optimization of the technology to get to the goals, the very specific goals around reducing inefficiencies, improving quality, improving safety, improving patient centeredness, and so forth. The third is, while we do this, we have to maintain trust in the technology. We have to maintain trust around safety and around privacy and security, critically. We cannot take risks. We can't compromise the safety and the trust of the patients in the systems. The fourth is to use the technology not only in doctors' offices and hospitals, the hopefully 0.001% of our lives where we actually spend in care settings, but in the 99.999% of the time that we're not in the doctor's office or the hospital. So to expand the ambit of health information technology to the consumer technology space, to applications and services that can help us manage our health and healthcare and healthcare finances. And finally, it's to create that framework for innovation and for learning to come. So those are the five strategic priorities for the Federal Health IT Strategic Plan.
I would like to turn to a term that folks are getting familiar with, which is meaningful use.
Yeah.
It's the adoption and meaningful use of health IT. First, would you explain for us what it means, meaningful use, and would you elaborate on the three-staged approach you've taken?
So meaningful use was actually a brilliant term that was coined in the legislation, the high-tech legislation that created this next phase as part of the stimulus bill. And what it said was that doctors and hospitals can earn these payments not just for buying a software system, but for actually using it in certain ways that are known to be associated with and prerequisites for the outcomes we wish to seek. It's defined in regulations, and it says these are the things you have to do in order to qualify for the incentive payments. I'll give you an example. Turns out blood pressure control, right? Only about half the time patients with high blood pressure have the blood pressure controlled. If we do a better job of that, we can save the most lives of anything. We basically say you got to be able to have quality measurement, decision support, registry functions, and you need to have all the data elements that go into doing those things. You have to have the blood pressure and the medications and the vital signs and the smoking status and so forth. Well, that's basically halfway to meaningful use, right? You got to be able to do those things. You're halfway to meaningful use. Then the next thing we want providers to do and what they want to do is not kill people. So What kills people? Well, Medicare, start with medication safety. A couple 100,000 adverse events, deaths a year from medication errors. Well, now we're 80% of the way to what people have to do to become meaningful users, and so on. So meaningful use takes the goals and it says these are the behaviors that are associated with doing that. We understand you can't get there in one leap, right? And we want the most number of people to begin this massive change operation. And so we said, and the legislation permitted, doing it in stages. Stage one, start collecting the data, get your feet wet. Stage two is a real push on data interoperability and exchanging information. Stage three, we've said aspiration is going to be about more and more about outcomes, not checking the box on this or that or collecting data or even getting to good processes. It's really after you've been doing it for 4 or 5 years, it's now to step up to outcomes. So that's kind of the staged approach that we're thinking for meaningful use.
So what are some of the barriers you've faced that you've seen in the recent trying to adopt, implement, and achieve meaningful use? And how have you used the lessons learned from those barriers to influence your path forward?
One barrier is change is hard. Change is really hard. And this is a big change in how we do work. And it's not very well fit to the reimbursement of today, which values, you know, seeing more and more and more patients with less and less time. So the problems that you run into there are, one, there's a lot of providers who really need a helping hand to be able to implement this effectively and to optimize the technology, because just putting it in is the first step, and really it's the optimization that is so critical to getting to the outcome. So I can talk more about the regional health IT extension centers and the important work that they've done. Another challenge comes around the usability of the systems. And a lot of providers and a lot of us in nowadays have gotten used to software and hardware that work together in very intuitive ways. And then interoperability, as I mentioned, having the systems talk to each other is critical. I think those are some of the challenges, and there's many, many more, but some of the main challenges that we are taking, I think, good positive steps in resolving, but this is not going to be an easy or a short journey.
So, Doctor, you're not doing this necessarily alone. The HITECH Act called for the creation and establishment of two federal advisory committees. I'd like to talk about them. What's their mission, and can you tell me how you interact with them, and what's their accomplishments to date?
This has been actually one of the most interesting parts of running this process. So these committee, the policy committee in particular, was explicitly created to represent these broad stakeholder viewpoints. The Government Accountability Office points the majority of them, the House minority and majority leaders, the Senate, the majority and minority leaders also appoint their representatives to the committee in certain roles. And the committee, the policy committee, gives me and then the secretary recommendations on how the policies should be aligned. And the standards committee really tells us what are the national standards that are needed to move us forward on interoperability. And when the opportunity came with the HITECH legislation, we expanded that nationwide. And we now have, and this is really a kind of a breathtaking statistic I hope your listeners will appreciate. I think it's the largest medical technical assistance project in history. 140,000 primary care docs in America have gotten assistance. And the GAO found that they're 2.3 times as likely to get to meaningful use. And these are in some of the toughest places to go to. We went to the smallest practices. We went to the poorest counties. We went to the most rural areas, the critical access hospitals. And there is now a regional health IT extension center that is there for every part of the United States and territories. And they've been really amazing examples of how with federal support and convening, but local knowledge, local resources, we can make big, big things happen.
How has the nationwide adoption and use of health IT, especially electronic health records, progressed? We will ask Dr. Farzad Mostashari, National Coordinator for Health IT, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. What is fast government, and how can focusing on time and speed deliver real and lasting benefits? How are changing work habits and technology decreasing the federal government's real estate footprint? And how are VA and HUD working to end chronic homelessness among veterans? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. We go beyond the buzz to introduce and connect our readers to actual public sector executives who are changing the way government does business. All of this and more in the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine. Order your free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Dr. Farzad Mostashari, National Coordinator for Health IT within the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Also joining us from IBM is Gio Patterson. So, Farzad, interoperability is at the heart of your overall effort. Would you tell us what are some of the critical barriers to achieving the goal of nationwide interoperability, and how are you working to overcome any of these challenges and obstacles?
The challenges to interoperability, widespread interoperability, national interoperability in a system that's incredibly fragmented. You have hundreds of different vendors. You have proprietary vendor interests. You don't have a strong and compelling business case. You don't have established structures for transferring trust between organizations, right? That's a major, massive, massive challenge. And I think fundamentally we need to do two things. One, we need to recognize there's not going to be, in a country as diverse as ours with partners and exchanges and transactions that are as varied as we have, there's not going to be a one-size-fits-all solution. It's not going to be a cookie cutter of like, here, everyone do this, right? Everyone use this mechanism. The corollary to that is that health information exchange is a verb, not a noun. There was, I think, a certain stage in our thinking at nationally. It was the idea that there were going to be RIOs in every community, and that's how all information exchange was going to happen. I think they're a critical part of the puzzle, but that's not the only way that information exchange can happen or indeed is happening. There's also direct communication between one provider and another provider, one hospital and another hospital, one vendor and another vendor, and that's okay. It's good. All exchange is good. And there's another approach, which is the patient getting their own information and sharing it whoever they want to share it with. That's fantastic. Not every patient is going to take that up, but if they want to, they should be able to serve as their own kind of HIE of one, as it were. But all of these, while there's a lot of variability and there's beauty in that variability, we can't be reinventing the wheel. And so there's got to be common building blocks to this. And that's where the standards come in. So to say, you want to exchange, you know, documents in a query model, or you want to exchange documents with the patient, or you want to exchange documents between each other, let's standardize on what those documents look like so that we don't have to do that fitting every single time for every single transaction. So we brought people together and say, hey, there used to be religious wars fought over, do you use the consolidated, you know, the C32 CCD, or do you use the ASTM E31 CCR? And we said, look, you know, guys, we really don't care, but we want to pick one as a country. And it turned out that we couldn't pick one. We had to create kind of an amalgam that took the strengths of both. And we resolved 1,500 technical issues, problems with either one or the other in creating and getting endorsed and consensus endorsement for the Standards Development Organization for the first time in our nation's history, a single standard for how patient information is summarized together. Same with standards for the vocabularies, having a single standard for medication lists for crying out loud instead of five different proprietary vocabularies. And there's also the standards around the transport and the protocol so that everyone can catch and throw with directed messaging, and we're moving on towards query-based exchange. So those are the technical standards that is firmly in our purview and frankly, a lot of attention paid to. But I just want to mention that it's not enough to have the technical standards in place. And we are making good progress on getting the technical standards through the 2014 standards and certification criteria. But you also need to have a reason to share. It's got to be, you know, sharing has got to be caring, and you got to be profitable to share, not to hoard patient data. So the incentives of the different participants in the healthcare system have to be aligned with sharing information, not locking it in. And that's why things like the readmission adjustment make such a big difference, where if I just discharged a patient, I, as a hospital, care financially that they get hooked up with their primary care doc, that if they show up in someone else's emergency room 3 days later, I really want to send them the information about their discharge. I want the patient to have information about their discharge. So it's just a paper in JAMA about how often, and it's no surprise, but it's shocking nonetheless, how often patients really don't understand their discharge instructions from the hospital. And of course, you're going to have worse problems and more complications and poor coordination if that happens. So one, standards. Two, the financial alignment. And then three is trust. And once you have the cost and benefit right, you reduce the cost through standards, you increase the benefits through policy changes and payment changes, then information will flow at the speed of trust. And so how can we create mechanisms, and you can't force it, but how can we create mechanisms that will foster a quicker sense of trusting relationships developing between different participants in the system? A lot of it has to start local because that's where most healthcare is shared. But setting some policy rules of the road can help get that forward.
Actually, I'd like to – that's a great follow-on because I'd like to talk to you about that effective governance or rules to the rule. How important is that? And your office chose to to do a framework rather than direct regulation. Why is that?
So this was labeled Zen and the Art of Government by someone. The idea was that we initially went into this thinking was, okay, in order to have trust, these organizations that will help move information around, they need to be trusted. And there need to be common rules about how they operate. Conditions for interoperability on standards, conditions for trust and on privacy and their privacy and security practices, on how they deal with meaningful choice or consent on the part of patients, what they do with the data once they have it and their reuse or lack of reuse of the data, what their business practices are in terms of putting up barriers or not, in terms of exchanging information or provider directories. So a whole list of these are the conditions for to be an accredited or something, nationally accredited exchange organization. And we put it out there. Not in a rule, but in a request for information. What do people think about this framework? And it was informed by all the discussions we had in our health IT policy committee. And what we heard back was, guys, we really appreciate you wanting to help, but there's a lot happening right now, and you may be trying to solve problems that don't exist, or we don't know what the problems are. And by doing regulations, by even saying you're going to do regulations, you're going to absolutely freeze everything while we wait for daddy to tell us what we can do. And that there's so much happening, that so much dynamism in the private sector around exchange, that picking any one model could stifle, could have the opposite effect of what you want. And instead, they said, the vast majority of the comments was, tell us the principles. Don't get too detailed. Tell us what are the principles and work with private-public collaborations that are already coming together around those rules of the road. And so we said, well, it's time to listen. We're not forestalling the possibility of doing it in the future if the needs emerge. But for now, maybe the better part of valor is to wait and to see and to support and to lean into it and to put out our statement of principles and the framework that you referred to have cooperative agreements with now two emerging governance entities. One is called Direct Trust that is creating an accreditation framework for health information service providers. The other is a group of states led out of New York, the New York eHealth Initiative Collaborative, and to bring those guidances together and then to have a forum for governance discussions through the National eHealth Collaborative. So that's what we're doing. We're leaning into it, but in a non-regulatory way. And, we remain open, I think, if it turns out that the way things are going, there's a sense that we need that regulatory approach to it. We won't hesitate to do that. But I think there's some promising signs that actually these governance approaches are maturing and they are developing and they are meeting the need.
Would you tell us more about the Beacon Community Program and how it's shown that health information exchanges meet real business needs and brings value to the industry?
Yeah. So we funded 17 Beacon communities from, New Orleans and Utah and Hawaii and San Diego to Maine, Tulsa, Oklahoma, and everywhere in between. And these were communities that would organize around some clear outcome goals and to use technology at the community level to achieve those goals. And we've just learned so much from these communities. And their work is going to – I mean, I think we're going to see a beacon nation, not a – you know, this, the work is going to continue far beyond these 17 named communities. But they've really been pioneers and a microcosm of where we are in the United States. But here are some lessons that I think we've learned. The first is it's incredibly important to set goals, to have focus at the community level. That is so helpful because right now providers are getting 1,000 different signals. It's just white noise. This health plan wants me to work on the mammography HEDIS scores. This one is talking to me about smoking. This one's saying do cancer screen. This one's saying do immunizations. This one, right? What am I supposed to work on? What do we want? Right? What do we want to do together? That's one. Two is the importance of governance, of competitors in a market. And we have a lot of competition in healthcare, but competitors agreeing that they're not going to compete on the basis of some things. These are the things we're going to compete on. These are the things we're not going to compete on. And prime among them being patient data. Mm-hmm. We're not going to compete on who can hoard patient data the most or lock patients into their information system the most effectively. Let's not compete on that because it's what's best for everybody. The third to me was the need for kind of an air campaign, which is the health information exchange across different sites that knits that together and does quality measurement and benchmarking across the community, but also the ground troops, the care transformation at the ground level in the practices that helps them change the habits of healthcare and how critical that is. So those are, I think, some of the lessons I'll share about the beacons.
So far, Farzad, recognizing the need to understand how health IT can promote patient safety as well as identify and mitigate risks, your office commissioned an Institute of Medicine study to determine how government and the private sector can work collaboratively to maximize patient safety vis-a-vis health IT. Would you tell us more about the key findings from the IOM report, Health IT and Patient Safety, Building a Safer System for Better Care? And to what extent have you folks leveraged the recommendations in that report?
What we became aware of, and I think it's pretty compelling, is that even though the most important thing we can do for safety is to get off paper, and that's pretty clear, and the IOM and everyone else, I think, has affirmed that by far moving to electronic health records is a lot safer than staying on paper. But that move, that transition, and also the environment you have with electronic health records can potentially introduce different challenges to patient safety. And that we need to, even just like, you know, vaccines, right? Even while a vaccine that's newly introduced has a potential of saving a lot of lives, we also want to be sure that we track and can understand any and improve any problems that can come from it. And what we said was, how big a problem is this? And what do we need to do to improve it? And the IOM came back and said, first of all, we really don't have good enough reporting of the safety events and analysis, most importantly, of reports that come in to be able to really answer that question. So the first thing is we really need to improve the reporting of safety events. And by safety events, I think broadly we have to think not only where, I don't know, there was some software miscoding that could potentially introduce an error in certain situations, but the bigger issue of if we're not preventing a hazard through the use of technology that could prevent it, that's an event too. And that's something that we need to take care of as well. So they recommended, they said, look, we don't think that this is something that's a good fit for the FDA, which is the other federal agency that does a lot of regulation around devices and under the Food and Drug Act. We think that this isn't just about the technology. It's about the whole environment in a hospital or in a doctor's office of how it's implemented, the socio-technical, they called it, interactions. Was it a configuration issue? Is it a workflow issue? Is it a data issue? Is it a culture issue, right? That it's more akin to safety in hospitals more broadly, separate apart from the health IT piece of it. But you really need, there's some very specific things we need to do to improve that. And so based on that report, we put out a surveillance and action plan, which says let's use our existing authorities. The Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality has authorities and has a program around voluntary patient safety organizations. By gosh, let's use that. Let's use patient safety organizations that give protections for liability from providers who report safety events, and let's use the data from those PSOs. Let's analyze them centrally and learn from that. The CMS has authorities around surveys and certification of hospitals with the Joint Commission that does surveys of safe conditions in hospitals. Let's add the health IT safety dimension to that. And we have we're doing more training with our CMS colleagues. We're tweaking the requirements, and we have a sole source contract with the Joint Commission to incorporate that. And let's use the authorities that ONC has through the certification program to require user-centered design and quality management systems and so forth with the vendor space. But it's not just a government job. This is everyone needs to participate in this. And let's ask the vendors to step up and to do their part and to commit to never barring a provider from reporting a safety event, as many feared some vendors were doing, of engaging with patient safety organizations in the reporting and mitigating and bringing that transparency to bear. And I'm very glad that the Electronic Health Record Association put out a code of conduct that said these are the things we believe vendors should do and should not do, importantly. And among those was exactly these issues. So I think we're still making progress, but still a lot of work to be done in terms of creating these reporting systems, the mitigation and the understanding of it. But I really do urge anyone who is using the systems, who has concerns, who sees something that could be improved, to contact the vendor. But more importantly, if there's something, to contact the patient safety organization and to report it, and so we can learn from that together.
Okay, great. So Farzad, we'd like to explore the benefits and risks associated with mobile technology in healthcare. Would you outline the benefits of these new technologies to enhance patient engagement and experience? What are the risks? What have you done to mitigate those risks?
So they're fabulous, right? It's great. We love it. They're always with us. They're connected to the internet and therefore to the world. They're platforms where it's not just the software that comes with it, but anyone can build software and I can choose what I want on it, right? So those are the strengths of the mobile technologies that extend to the consumers, but also to the medical field. Why wouldn't doctors and nurses want to have devices with them that are ubiquitous and connected and platforms, right? So of course they're taking off. And every one of those characteristics, every one of those attributes also introduces risks. They are always with us, so we can lose them. So you can lose your patient information, for example, if you have it on your mobile device and it gets stolen or lost or left in the bar. So you gotta safeguard that. They are connected to the internet, which means that you can introduce security threats and people hacking into the mobile devices and potentially compromising that patient information. They are platforms. And so, again, you can have malicious software that is just a little bit of software that you download onto your device that then has access to all the other information in the device. So there are security threats that come with this that are really significant. And we've worked with many different federal partners, including, importantly, the Office of Civil Rights and the National Institute of Standards and Technology, to come out with guidance and some, I think, technology and toolboxes to help people mitigate the risks that do come with the mobile technology, even as we encourage, really, the use of these new technologies.
Accelerating health IT may require advanced breakthrough research to overcome certain barriers to adoption. To that end, how does the Strategic Health IT Advanced Research Project, or SHARP, factor into your innovation efforts? Also, more specifically, how are you leveraging the HHS-sponsored challenge program? Maybe you could share with us any recent innovations in this area?
Yeah, on the innovation space, I mean, obviously we had a lot of our emphasis on the nuts and bolts of implementation, but we always have to look to the future as well. And the stimulus bill gave us an opportunity to invest in some more basic research and development work, which is a traditional role for government in innovation. We're not going to be able to continue that level of investment. We put $60 million into the different university consortia that comprise the SHARP program. But there are other government programs that do fund this sort of research, and I think we need to coordinate again with them to keep this momentum going. But the idea was to bring consortia together around privacy and security, around secondary use of data, around substitutable medical applications and new ways of connecting information, around cognitive support for providers, around decision support and quality measurement and so forth. And that, I think, is going to yield benefits for years to come, that basic science investment. But something that's a little less traditional than funding R&D and university research is the approach we've taken with just, not that much money, but in this innovation portfolio. We're a very early and aggressive user of the America Competes Act capabilities from America Competes Act of 2010 in issuing challenges and awards and prizes. And this is wonderful as a way of getting pointing industry in a direction of this is something important to work on. It's been really important for us to get away from the mindset that we have to do government contracting for everything that we need. So, I'll give you one example. The idea was, why don't we make Medicare claims data available to Medicare beneficiaries? This is the concept behind the blue button is it's your data. You can get it. You can download it. But there are many people who are concerned that the Medicare claims file or really any other basic download dump of information you have on a patient is going to be, gosh, really hard for the average 70-year-old or even her MD son to understand. And so shouldn't we first, before we just give them the data, shouldn't we build applications and a portal and give a contract to maybe one of your listeners to develop the thing? And I'm sorry for them, but that's not the approach we chose. Instead, we said instead of paying one vendor, one contractor to develop this for probably a lot of money, and it would be pretty difficult to tweak it and modify it over time and meet all the needs of all the different people who have it, we said, look, we're just going to make the data available. But we're also going to put out a challenge to call different companies to this issue. Let them know this data will be becoming available, and it'd be great. It'd be really lovely if you developed an application to help patients make use of it and mash it up with other sources of data that we've also made available through APIs, the National Provider Index, the National Ira Medicines, PubMed, Medline Plus data, and so forth. And we got great responses to this for really very little money. And now there are applications that my mom can download that help her make good use of that data. And best of all, we didn't really have to pay for it.
So before we close this segment, I just want to get this in. How critical is it to have an interoperable health information technology infrastructure in place to sustain many of the reforms outlined in the Affordable Care Act?
I do think it's critical. I think that these are two hands that wash each other. That you need the payment reform to create a business case for care coordination, for example, reducing readmissions, accountable care organizations, value-based modifiers, bundled payments. Those are all critical. And I think people underappreciate how much the Affordable Care Act had provisions in it for new payment and delivery models, not just insurance reform. But in order for those models to succeed, those providers need to have the tools and the information to be able to do the care coordination and the population health management and so forth. So we really need to do both and to provide the technology infrastructure for care coordination and population health management and patient engagement at the same time as we create the incentives for it. My concern is that even those are not enough, that we in a sense need a third hand or a third strand of DNA to create the new healthcare system, which is the know-how of how you use the technology to meet the new delivery and payment needs. And that, I think, is a real opportunity for us to learn and to teach others rapidly how to meet the needs of these new payment models.
What does the future hold for the national adoption and use of health IT? We will ask Dr. Farzad Mastashari, National Coordinator for Health IT, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. What is fast government, and how can focusing on time and speed deliver real and lasting benefits? How can serendipitous collision change the way agencies do business?
How are changing work habits and technology decreasing the federal government's footprint? Get your latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. We go beyond the buzz to introduce and connect our readers to actual public sector executives who are changing the way government does business. All of this and more in the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine. Get your free copy at businessofgovernment.org.
How is National Defense University's iCollege expanding its missions as a global hub for educating, informing, and connecting information age leaders? What about the iCollege's Cyber Beacon program? How is NDU's iCollege continuing to enhance its global perspective? Join host Michael Keegan as he explores these questions and a lot more with Dr. Robert Childs, Chancellor of the Information Resources Management College, iCollege, at the National Defense University, next week on the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Dr. Farzad Mostashari, National Coordinator for Health IT within the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Also joining us from IBM is Gio Patterson.
Farzad, you have noted that physicians' dissatisfaction with electronic health records may rise as implementation goes beyond the early adopters. To that end, your incentive programs have carrots and sticks. When do the penalties kick in for not adopting electronic records? And how do you anticipate and prepare to handle the challenge of onboarding the next round of providers beyond the early adopters?
The program really is at a point where now we have some 90% of hospitals, 70% of eligible professionals who've engaged with the program. And we really are getting into now the point where it's almost accepted that you're going to do this. And that sense, I think, of inevitability is very important to maintaining progress. My hope is that nobody will decide that they would rather take the penalties rather than move into modernized use of electronic health records. That does happen by the end of this year. In 2013 is being able to, if you meet it in 2013 and then 2014 is kind of the last chance, then in 2015 is when the payment adjustments start. So providers really need to get moving if they haven't already, and I think most have. But get moving, because it's not just, you know, avoiding the penalty program. It's really what is the kind of healthcare of the future, and what are the skills that are going to be and the capabilities that are going to be required to be empowered, to be able to manage your own population, manage your own quality measures, understand your quality of care you're providing, and to take steps to meet the needs of the new payment systems that are coming down the road and not fall victim to them. That's the real reason where people should and I think are going to be adopting the technology. It's not to avoid the 1%, 2%, 3%, whatever payment adjustment. It's the broader goal of improving health and healthcare.
Well, I've had the pleasure on the show to have each one of your predecessors on. And it's great to have you today. And one thing I've noticed is that you're really not engaged in simply a technology project. It's more of a social change project. Could you tell us a little bit more about that? And how does partnership and collaboration factor into it all?
It is absolutely a change. I mean, everything that we do, we have to think about how change happens. And, you know, it's the idea behind having a regional extension center program that says, we want to shrink the change here and simplify it for someone who sometimes it seems like resistance, where it's just we don't know what to do. And so we simplified the message of call or contact your regional extension center. That's what you got to do. Don't worry about trying to read 600 pages of regs, right? Shrink that change. We want to create a sense of momentum. We want to highlight the bright spots, like the Beacon community, so the Meaningful Use Vanguard, to get change. You want to paint a destination postcard. This is what it's going to look like. This is why you want to do the change. You want to recruit the herd, right? You got to say there are other people who are doing this and share and create those communities of practice.